Two letters, one number, B, A, and five. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 21st of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We lead today with the news out of the White House that after dodging it for two-something years, President Biden has tested positive for COVID. Mild symptoms, he's isolating, taking Paxlovid. That is basically the whole story so far, at least as far as the chief executive is concerned. As far as the whole rest of the economy is concerned, there is plenty more of a tale to tell, because with the BA5 subvariant-inspired surge in cases that we are enjoying right now, it is not at all clear that we're on the economic far side of this pandemic. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab gets us going.
If you ask business experts if we're still living in a pandemic economy, well,
we are. It's not blowing quite as hard as it was a year ago or certainly 2 years ago, but it's still blowing.
I think we are feeling the effects of coming out of a pandemic.
It depends. Yes and no.
That's Mark Zandi, Keely Croxton, and Charles Lindsay. Let's start with Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, which actually measures the pandemic economy with its back-to-normal index. Its most recent reading says we're about 10% away from being back to normal.
I think that's meaningful. We feel it. Do you feel normal? I don't quite feel normal.
One of the biggest ways COVID is still affecting the economy is inflation, which is above 9%. Zandi attributes about 1.5% of that to the pandemic, mostly from lingering supply chain problems. Keely Croxton, a logistics professor at The Ohio State University, says they'd started to work themselves out.
But now there's threats of new lockdowns, and those will have direct effects on the U.S. and world economies.
Current outbreaks in China, coupled with the country's zero COVID policy, are putting manufacturing at risk. And even here in the U.S., the new subvariant is threatening productivity.
We still have people that are, you know, having to call out sick and quarantine and all those things.
Though, if you looked at people's behavior, you might not know it. TSA checkpoint data show the number of people flying is almost back to what it was before the pandemic, and spending at bars and restaurants is strong. But foot traffic data tells a different story. Charles Lindsay researches consumer behavior at the University at Buffalo.
There's still some hesitancy when it comes to mall shopping, big box retail store shopping, crowded events.
Sure, some behaviors have changed. People are shopping online and commuting less, but many people are still planning their lives around the virus, maybe lying low in the days leading up to a wedding or trip to see the parents or their kids' summer camp.
People are making trade-offs, and I don't think those trade-offs are going to go away anytime soon.
We certainly haven't returned to normal, but it doesn't mean we've settled into the new normal either. Maybe for now, we're just floating somewhere in between. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
It's never good being in between. On Wall Street today, things were up and then up and then up a little more. Have we hit bottom, do you think, or is it a bear market rally? Well, we report, you decide, but we'll always have the details when we do the numbers. Depending on where they are ambient weather-wise, farmers in this economy are starting to plan for harvest season, keeping an eye on their crops and making their educated best guesses on yields and thus profits. And just like the rest of us and the rest of, you know, businesses, farmers aren't immune from broader economic trends, which are not completely great right now, as we all know. Patrick Smith runs Loftus Ranches up in Yakima, Washington. Apples and hops are what he and the family grow. Patrick Smith, it's good to talk to you again. Been a while. It's been a long while.
Yeah, good to talk to you too, Kai.
It's been like a year and a half. First of all, the standard warm-up question, how's business?
You know, we're hanging in there. You know, we've got our challenges related to some of the macroeconomic stuff going on that I'm sure we'll talk about. But overall, beer's still a good business. People are still eating fruit and vegetables. And so overall, I don't have that much to complain about, actually.
All right. Well, good. That's good news. Now let's break it down to macroeconomics and the stuff you grow. Hops, first of all, obviously beer. You guys run a brewery as well. Did I remember you telling me at some point that you sell a bunch of your hops over in Europe, right?
Yeah, that's correct. About a third of our total production is sold over over in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's do a little foreign currency exchange here. And as you well know, the dollar and the euro are darn near at parity. I don't know where they are exactly today, but it's pretty close to 1-to-1. That cannot be good for your business on contracts that I imagine were signed when the euro was not at parity.
Yeah, I think our weighted average contract price over in Europe is somewhere in the, you know, $13, $15 range. We do have some expenses over there in Europe, personnel and you know, logistics and stuff like that, that we can pay, you know, with the revenue that we receive in euros. But when we bring whatever's left back over to the U.S. here, of course, we're getting 10 to 15% fewer dollars than we used to.
That doesn't seem like a viable business proposition.
It's tough, but it's part of the risk of doing international business is currency risk, of course. And so we do some hedging and stuff like that to help minimize our exposure. But certainly for exporters like us, you know, this significant dollar strength does impact our ability to be competitive in those markets.
Okay, so the monster under the bed, as it were, inflation. What does that mean for you, a guy running a family business, a farm, a ranch, in the Yakima Valley in Washington?
Yeah, I mean it's affecting us. Actually, you know, our wages are up 7%+ this year over last year, and you know, other major cost categories for us. In some cases, some fertilizer materials are up nearly double from where they had been. You know, even just a year or two ago, and you know, when I look at our top four or five cost categories, and wages being up 7% is on the lower end of increases. You know, that's definitely squeezing margins. Substantially for us.
What is your ability then to pass on cost to your consumers?
Yeah, it's really limited. Really? You know, generally farmers are price takers versus price setters. And, you know,
So that means you have to take the price that you can get, basically.
Yep. Yep. Huh. You know, a lot of our products are easily substituted with products in other, you know, coming from other parts of the world or other parts of the United States. And so, you know, a lot of our contracts are multi-year contracts that were signed when inflation was, you know, 2%. And, you know, we built our kind of five-year plan on 2% inflation. And, you know, now with inflationary pressures where they are, that's certainly looking, you know, a little less attractive than maybe it did, you know, 2 or 3 years ago.
Overall, then, Loftus Ranches, are you guys doing well? Are you hanging in? Are you grinding it out? What are you doing?
Yeah, you know, I think overall we're doing well. You know, every year has its challenges. I mean, what we talked 2 years ago about all the challenges that we were having with our labor force and COVID and what that was doing. And, you know, now it's a new challenge. But overall, we're doing all right. We're doing all right.
He's ranching. He's running the family business. And he and his siblings run the brewery as well. It's called Bale Breakers. The brewery, Loftus Ranches, is the place they grow the apples and the hops. Patrick Smith up in Yakima, Washington. Patrick, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time. Really good to talk to you again.
Yeah, thank you, Kai. It's a pleasure.
Kristen was telling us about the virus and whether we're over it and whether it's over us. The answer to that one, by the way, is of course no. But she mentioned those TSA throughput numbers, how many people are going through airport security and how it's basically back to where it was in the before times. Well, see also United Airlines, which reported more than $12 billion in quarterly revenue yesterday, the most the company's taken in a decade. This morning, American told investors it made its first quarterly profit since the pandemic hit. A lot of bottoms in those seats on those full planes are vacationers tired of putting their vacations off. But as Marketplace's Matt Levin reports, a more lucrative passenger is also returning to the skies.
Justin Strelow is generally thrilled to be traveling for business again, although he's not thrilled with every part of it.
I do not eat at the airport. I am trying to drop a few pounds. I'm trying to drop my pandemic weight.
Strelo is the founder of Incisive, a Kansas City-based company that makes software for hospital labs. In 2 weeks' time, Strelo will be flying himself and three employees to Anaheim for an industry trade show. Even without the airport Cinnabons, the trip will cost this small business around $15,000.
I am still kind of old school. I like face-to-face with folks. We've found the value of getting in front of people in person and really kind of solidifying those relationships.
That is music to the airline industry's ears. Before the pandemic, business travel accounted for more than 50% of profits, says Ryan Mann with the consulting firm McKinsey.
Business travelers tend to book at the last minute, and that's when prices are the highest.
Business travel is about 70% of where it was in 2019, according to the aviation data company ARC. Mann says Zoom has replaced smaller in-person meetings that used to involve travel.
But conferences, frankly, are filling the gaps.
As are corporate retreats and team building trips, where remote employees can finally see how tall their coworkers are. While business travel is trending up, it's an open question whether it will ever recover fully, especially if there's a recession. Chris Raitt is an analyst at the investment research firm Third Bridge.
That's an area where they can cost cut, and there is a clearly proven alternative in Zoom.
Plus, you don't have to worry about your Zoom getting delayed because of a pilot shortage. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Matt Levin, by the way, taller than he looks on Zoom. Anyway, coming up.
I was exhausted after every meal.
Running a B&B ain't no breakfast in bed, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 162 points today, about a 0.5%, closed at 32,036. The NASDAQ rose 161 points, 1.3%, finished at 12,059. The S&P 500 moved up 39 points, about 1%, 39.98 there. Matt was telling us about the uptick in airline business travel. Yeah, so what? American Airlines dropped 7.4% today. United gave back 10% on worse-than-expected quarterly revenue and profits. Here in a moment about the market for used cars. A little sneak peek there as the shortage of new cars continues. Electric vehicle maker Tesla sped up 9.75% today on better-than-expected second-quarter earnings. They came out yesterday, and you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The biggest auto retail chain in the country reported quarterly results today, made plenty of money. AutoNation did. Record profits, in fact, despite merely so-so sales, thanks to high prices for said autos in this nation. And we got an update on the car shortage, too. The company said there are still plenty of supply chain issues, but there is hope, especially if you're in the market for a used car. Demand for them has finally started to slow. Prices haven't quite followed yet. Soon, though, getting your hands on a used car might not mean taking drastic measures like some of the ones Savannah Marr heard about today. She brings us dispatches from the used car lot.
Michael Castens of Little Rock, Arkansas, spent 3 months scouring the market for a used electric car.
It's Fury Road out there, like a Mad Max vibe right now.
He finally found a Chevy Volt through an online retailer. He paid more than he was hoping to for it, but traded in his old car for more than he was expecting.
You know, I bought my Honda Insight in 2018 for $27,000, and I traded it to them for $27,000.
It's tougher if you don't have a vehicle to trade in, says Lee Diaz. She and her wife have been worried about finding a car for their impending move away from New York City. So when a friend in California put their 2018 Subaru up for sale,
we were like, okay, we need to jump on this.
They spent $22,000 on the car, $1,700 to ship it, and a lot of time managing the logistics.
It honestly felt like project management at the utmost level.
That's what a lot of used car shoppers have been in for lately, says Michelle Krebs with Cox Automotive.
It just takes a little more work. It takes more research. It takes more flexibility.
And a lot more money. Used car prices are up more than 40% since before the pandemic. But Krebs says inventories and demand are both approaching something we might call normal, at least compared to the new car market. Joe Enton of Scranton, Pennsylvania, learned that the hard way. Last November, he thought he was trading in his 2017 Honda for a new electric truck.
It is now July 2022, and I never got my truck.
After months of waiting, he turned to the used car market and found a hybrid. It doesn't check all his boxes, but at least he has something to drive. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
We're going to round out the transportation trifecta on the show today with railroads, which literally makes it, by the way, planes, trains, and automobiles. The biggest freight railroads in this economy have been reporting earnings this month in the middle of what's honestly been kind of a fraught summer for them. Last week, President Biden blocked a freight strike for at least 60 days and named an arbitration panel to handle a looming contract dispute. But even without that, the seven major rail lines are dealing with a whole slew of problems right now, some of their own making, some not, but all of them trickling down to their customers and consumers. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is on the freight rail economy today.
Freight trains are the bloodstream of the economy, circulating products throughout the country. This is a CSX freight train on its regular route the other day, just outside Washington, D.C. It's hard to make out what's in there, and it could be lots of things. Imports from China, new cars, or even chicken feed. Foster Poultry Farms, a chicken grower and processor, needs four Union Pacific trains full of corn feed per week for its California operations. But starting in February, not all the trains were showing up. Max Fisher is chief economist at the National Grain and Feed Association, a trade group.
And if you have that happen for enough weeks in a row, eventually you run out of your reserves of corn, and then you start just depending on the next train to arrive in time so that you don't have to depopulate.
That's a polite way of saying kill the chickens so they don't starve. Fisher says government regulators ordered Union Pacific to improve its service to Foster Farms, but other grain, ethanol, and chemical shippers are still having problems. Fisher estimates rail service issues cost the grain industry more than $100 million in the first quarter of this year. The rail lines are in a quiet period ahead of second quarter earnings reports and wouldn't comment, but Ian Jefferies, head of the Association of American Railroads, would.
So without a doubt, rail service is not where we want it to be or where some of our customers expect it to be. And we've been working hard to reduce the backlog of shipments on the grain front.
Jefferies says part of the problem is the rail lines can't find enough workers. And Jefferies says no one could have predicted the pandemic or the resulting supply chain snags. Sandra Dearden is a former freight rail executive who started her own consulting company. She says Jefferies has a point.
There are some issues that were out of their control, but at the same time, some of the decisions they made prior to the pandemic contributed to the problems that we have today.
Dearden says the major rail lines started laying people off even before COVID hit the U.S., eventually getting rid of about a third of their workers. The layoffs were supposed to make the railroads more efficient. Marty Oberman is chair of the Surface Transportation Board, which regulates freight rail. He says the railroads were slimming down to appeal to investors.
It wasn't essential that they operate this way. I think it was instigated by pressures from Wall Street. It's really hard to call it anything other than greed.
But Ian Jefferies of the Association of American Railroads says the freight rail lines have to make money so they can maintain miles and miles of track and other infrastructure. This debate and all the complaints about freight rail came to a head last April at a board hearing, according to Marty Oberman.
We have a lot of authority to hold the railroads' feet to the fire, which is what I think we should be doing, and to keep the spotlight on them. And that can be a powerful tool.
Oberman says for now, the biggest freight rail lines have to report every week on their progress toward faster, more reliable service. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
past couple of years have been quite the boon for the short-term rental business. Remote work and people wanting to vacation in isolation helped drive record bookings on Airbnb and VRBO, or Vrbo, as the company prefers, and all the rest of them. And so far this summer, demand for those short-term rentals seems to be even stronger. So what do you do if you run a regular old B&B, as in bed and breakfast? That's where today's installment of our series Adventures in Housing comes in.
I'm Lori Howard.
I'm Bruce Howard.
And we're in Oakhurst, California. We're overlooking Yosemite Valley. I'm a little bit of a troublemaker. I wanted to get into the B&B business because I was only 52, I think. Not quite ready to retire, so trying to figure out what I wanted to do in the next phase of my life and bring my wonderful husband with me.
That was in October 2005. B&Bs were getting to be more and more popular at that point in time, so it was an attractive time to do that.
Lo and behold, we found a one-bedroom, two-story bachelor pad on top of a mountain and decided that was going to be our bed and breakfast. We did pay full price because, being from San Diego, $315,000 was a drop in the bucket. And we were able to build the rest of this B&B for a little over $100 a foot, which in this day and age is absolutely amazing.
We loved guests coming to our property right to the end. We had so many good experiences.
We did have a group from Hollywood come up, and we will not mention names, but they came up, gave us a list of what they could eat, when they could eat it, and it included stuff like, you know, some kind of a powder.
I was exhausted after every meal.
And then we had Joe Average and their family, and they were, you know, everyone, for the most part, were absolutely delightful. It's just that I think with COVID, people want to be on their own. They want to be able to do what they want to do and not worry about being in somebody else's house.
The migration has been to the VRBO, Airbnb-type properties versus a very service-driven bed and breakfast.
We ended up selling our bed and breakfast in May of 2022, so it was just 2 months ago, for close to $1.2 million.
We kind of looked at the numbers and went, oh, heck.
The people are turning it into a VRBO.
With the latest updates throughout the property. When you turn over a property, you sometimes just need to divorce yourself with saying they bought it, they paid for it, they'll make their own mistakes, and you just smile.
All the way to the bank.
Bank, yes.
That was pretty good, all the way to the bank. The Howards and their adventures in housing. Tell us yours, would you? You can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, quick update to an item we teased a little bit yesterday. The European Central Bank raised its benchmark interest rate today, half a percentage point. That's a little bit more than people had been guessing they would. It's the ECB's first increase in 11 years, its biggest bump since the year 2000, and comes as inflation, which again is a global phenomenon right now, not just here. Inflation in the European Union sits at 9.6%. All right, we're out. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It's a little bit reading the tea leaves, I grant you. And I know we said we're going to start paying less attention to first-time claims for unemployment now that they're basically back to where they were before. But I did just want to note the 251,000 people lost their jobs last week, the highest level of the year. And that is, without being a jerk about it, that's one of the things that happens as the Fed tries to get a handle on inflation. It just is. Amir Bibawe, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.